Welcome to the Forgettable Reads Podcast, a no-nonsense sleepcast for the rest of us. No creepy whispering, no bad spa music, no sleepy monotone. Just sincere reads of boring, bland material for all your verbal white noise needs. And now your host, Lauren Good.
Well, hello, my friends, and welcome to episode 13. Lucky 13. In the last session, we had a bit of a departure from our normal format and had an entirely personal, heart-centric ramble that was an intro that spanned the entire episode. So tonight, I'll try to keep balance in the force by keeping the intro shorter and briefer to leave time for a nice, lengthy reading at the end. So tonight, I am coming to you fresh from a staff training session at the Trapeze School that I have come to find is not only my happy place, but also the laboratory for practicing the principles I most believe in. I do believe that in order to grow and get the most out of life, you have to be willing to suck at something new. Not once or twice, but repeatedly. And while some elements of trapeze have become easier, well, not easier, more familiar over the last 2 years, like climbing the ladder. I think the board is 24 feet in the air. On day one, I had an entire internal coaching monologue to get to the top of the ladder. Okay, Lauren, you can do this. Breathe. Right arm, left leg, left arm, right leg. One limb, one breath at a time, until we reach the top. Or, at this point, the basic swing, where the choreography is completely backwards from any swinging you may have done as a kid on the playground. There is nothing intuitive about it whatsoever. And if you happen to be a person like me who always struggled with the pat your head while you rub your belly kind of synchronization, yeah, it's even more challenging than that. But now, as I am learning how to staff classes, I am learning to deal with many, many more moving parts. They're all at height and all completely out of my comfort zone. And they're just not in my wheelhouse in terms of ability or skill, or I should say at least an experience. So at the end of the day, the class day, when the staff breaks down the board to put it in storage overnight, you have to lean all the way out to take the bar off of the cables on the rig. Now, sometimes the platform shakes or the wind picks up, and then when you finally get over your nerves, one of the little connecting parts decides to stubbornly refuse to turn. And so you really have to put some force into it while not having a secure grasp on just about anything. If that is not a tangible way to practice dealing with uncertainty, I don't know what is. The first time I did it, I chickened out less than a quarter of the way through. I just did not think I could do it. It felt like way too much. But because I believe in not taking those kinds of thoughts as a solid reality, I pushed myself to try it again a few weeks later. I made it halfway this time before I had to hand the bar off to the coach who was teaching me. And then a few weeks later, I made it almost all the way through. But I needed a break towards the end to steady my nerves and give my forearms a healthy shake. Then, once I had successfully broken the board down, the next and last part is climbing down the ladder backwards, holding the bar. I said, "No way. I need both of my hands for the ladder. You don't understand." So tonight, I decided to give that part a try. Sure enough, just like all the other staff members who can successfully hold a heavy metal bar wrapped in tape and gauze while climbing a ladder, I was able to make it to the bottom safely. I went very slowly, I went at a pace that I felt comfortable with, and lo and behold, all was well. Now, things may not and don't always turn out the way I want to or we want to in life, but I sure do think making non-fear-based decisions is important, to do it as much as we can. There's no way on some of those nights when I chickened out, I would have been able to push through. That was not a day for pushing. But I think anytime you can say, maybe I could just do two more pieces, two more steps, two more inches, I think that's where the balance lies. And speaking of balance, for tonight's reading, we will return to one of my favorite LinkedIn authors, who's also a best-selling author, doctor, and thought leader, Deepak Chopra, A Life-Changing Choice, The Wave or the Ocean. A Life-Changing Choice, The Wave or the Ocean, by Deepak Chopra, MD, FACP, FRCP. If you look at the difference between the ocean and a wave on the ocean, you are on the verge of a momentous decision. You can choose a vision of your life that is either finite or infinite. The most important choice that all of us face is also one the vast majority of people ignore. What vision should I live by? For centuries, there were ready-made visions in form of religion, but there have always been lesser visions that exerted a tight grip, such as what tribe, nation, or ethnic group you belong to. The same visions still exist, but in modern society, they aren't automatic. Free choice is available as never before, but free choice is bewildering. The path of least resistance is to skip the whole notion of finding a vision to live by. In the whirlpool of activity that is modern life, countless distractions, diversions, worries, duties, and demands pull us in other directions. But to ignore a vision of life risks feeling empty and soul-sick, however you want to define the condition. More importantly, there might be a vision so beneficial that to miss it would be a great loss, even a tragedy. For centuries, just such a vision has existed. In fact, it is the ultimate vision as taught in every Eastern tradition, as well as the mystical offshoots in the West. Setting aside cultural differences, one image unites these traditions. The image I began with, of the wave and the ocean. Both are symbols. The wave symbolizes the active side of existence, which encompasses all thoughts, feelings, sensations, and physical actions. Like the ocean, these waves are constant and extend in all directions without limit. From the moment you were born, you are plunged into wave-like action. Your entire body and mind have been consumed by it ever since. And matters could have stood like that. Life never stops of its own accord. Finding an alternate vision required a momentous discovery that cannot be dated in history or prehistory. The simplest name for this discovery is self-awareness, which begins with an experience everyone has had. I exist. I am here right now. This first step doesn't automatically lead anywhere. Existence is just a given until you take another step, which is self-inquiry. I exist can lead to questions about why I exist, what my purpose is, and where I fit into the scheme of nature. Those questions launch the questioner deeper into self-awareness. A journey begins, but it is a very peculiar journey. No destination is marked out in advance, no map, no fixed or predictable path. These factors are mystifying, which is why even dedicated seekers are turned back or get discouraged. There is nothing to cling to. Besides, the instant you look inward, a screen of mental activity, a jumble of thoughts, desires, wishes, fears, memories, and so on, blocks your view. Now what? This is where the image of the wave and ocean rescues us. It is obvious at first glance when standing on the shore that the waves rippling across the sea are made of the same water as the sea. The two are essentially the same. Suddenly, there is no mystifying journey to undertake. The reason self-awareness has no goal, path, or destination is that a single insight is the only necessity. It is the insight that, like the wave and the ocean, the jumble of mental and physical activity share the same essence. The essence of the ocean is water. The essence of mental and physical activity is consciousness. I am means two things at once. I am every tiny wave of activity, and I am the essence of life. Here it's good not to be waylaid by semantics. Only one term, essence, needs to be grasped. In another famous analogy from the Vedic tradition of India, many objects are made of gold, but no matter what shape, use, or other properties found in a gold watch, gold tooth, gold earring, etc., their essence is gold. The main reason that everyone isn't taught about the wave and ocean is that water and gold are physical, and we all have a bias for trusting things we can see and touch. As our essence, consciousness is invisible and intangible. The way we notice it isn't as an essence, but as mind in motion. Some philosophies skip the whole difficulty of infinite consciousness by saying, "My existence is proved by thinking, not by being here." In short, the waves have won out over the ocean time and time again. We blindly accept mind-made reality because no one has ever seen the ocean of pure consciousness from which creation springs. Enter the tricky field known as metaphysics, which bewilders everyone and seems to be of no help in everyday life. But the message of metaphysics is simple. Go beyond. Only humans can transcend the evidence of the five senses. When we do, we realize that our whole lives has been spent bouncing into the transcendent. The things we most value, love, compassion, empathy, insight, truth, and beauty, were not invented or mind-made. They are qualities that spring from our essence, our source and consciousness. No journey is needed to find them. I exist is enough. Far from being an act of faith or a sign of mysticism, going beyond is the whole reason humans are self-aware. I exist is the platform we stand on. Yet the instant there is a spark of self-awareness, life explodes in all directions to expand in love, beauty, creativity, and all the rest. Choosing to see yourself as the ocean instead of the wave or a collection of many, many, many waves gives you a platform to stand on. This platform stabilizes your existence. It gives you a shared existence with all things. It ends soul sickness, and in the end, once you are well established in this vision, you realize that you are whole. Deepak Chopra, MD, FACP, FRCP, founder of the Chopra Foundation, a nonprofit entity for research on well-being and humanitarianism, and Chopra Global, a whole health company at the intersection of science and spirituality, is a world-renowned pioneer in integrative medicine and personal transformation. Chopra is a clinical professor of family medicine and public health at the University of California, San Diego, and serves as a senior scientist with the Gallup organization. He's the author of over 90 books translated into 43 languages, including numerous New York Times bestsellers. His 91st book, Total Meditation, Practices in Living the Awakened Life, explores and reinterprets the physical, mental, emotional, relational, and spiritual benefits that the practice of meditation can bring. For the last 30 years, Chopra has been at the forefront of the meditation revolution. His latest book, Living in the Light, co-authored with Sarah Plott Finger, Time magazine has described Dr. Chopra as one of the top 100 heroes and icons of the century. For more information, visit www.deepakchopra.com. And now, bonus reading number 2. Why You Need Multiple Mentors by Alyssa F. Westring, June 22, 2021. When it comes to having a mentor, there is no one and only. You can gain a more valuable outlook by triangulating advice from multiple mentors. How do you find these mentors? Try mentor mapping. Chances are you've received the career advice to find a mentor from countless well-intentioned people, from career advisors to older relatives to your new boss. Of course, these people are right. Data clearly indicates that protégés, i.e. you, benefit from having a mentor. But if you take this advice too literally, it can also be pretty misleading. When we hear the words, find a mentor, we implicitly interpret them to mean find one mentor. And so when our organization assigns us a formal mentor, or we identify one ourselves, we assume that we've accomplished the task and can check it off our list. In reality, though, finding only one mentor may not be as useful as you think. In fact, it could do more damage than good. Let's first consider why this is a problem and then discuss what you can do about it. The problem. One of the benefits of having a mentor is you get to learn from their past experiences. If you ask the right questions, you can get their perspective on how to negotiate politics at work, ask for a raise, and which projects will get you the most visibility. The advice they dish out is shaped by their career path, values, and goals. This means, however well-intentioned they may be, their advice is also somewhat biased, and their baggage, good or bad, will inevitably become part of your journey. While this is true no matter how many mentors you have, you can gain a more valuable outlook by triangulating advice from multiple individuals. You can take bits and pieces of what each has to offer and decide for yourself which words of wisdom feel right for you at certain points in your career. That's much harder to do when if your mentor situation is a one and done. Another risk that emerges from the mythos of thinking the one is that a single mentor is unlikely to be an expert on all the things you need support with, especially early in your career. The transition from college to career is a time of rapid growth that will require you to make countless decisions: which job to choose, how to navigate financial independence, the best ways to deal with difficult coworkers, how to network, and so much more. It's unrealistic to expect one person to have all the answers. In addition, if you're looking for the holy grail of a mentor who is an expert at all of these things, you're not only setting yourself up for disappointment, you're also asking for a lot of their time and energy. For busy working professionals, this may be more responsibility than they want to take on. The question, "Will you be my mentor?" could be tough to say yes to. This burden is even higher on women and people of color, who are frequently asked to take on more mentoring than their white male counterparts. By diversifying your portfolio of mentors, you'll be able to get the support you need without overburdening one person and find the right people to help you navigate the problems they are uniquely well-suited to solve. The solution. If relying on one single mentor is a risky career proposition, the obvious solution is to pursue multiple mentors. Yet doing so effectively will take time and practice. Below, I describe steps you can take now to help you reframe your approach to mentoring and proactively develop a network of support that will help you thrive in your career and beyond. This process is frequently referred to as mentor mapping, and it serves as both a mindset shift and a planning tool. Here are a few steps you can take to rethink mentoring and approach it in a fresh and thoughtful way. 1. Envision what you want your career and life to look like 5 years down the road. What do you want to do? How do you want to feel? How will it be different from the present? 2, create a list of the different types of support you will need to get from where you are now to where you want to be. Think creative and expansively. What knowledge do you need to obtain? What skills will you need to develop? What connections will you need to make? The answers can and should encompass the broad array of support you'll need as you progress both professionally and personally. 3, next, consider who currently fulfills these roles in your life. Who do you go to for emotional support now? Where are you getting your negotiation advice? Under each category, write down as many names as you can think of. If you don't have any names for a particular category right now, don't worry about it. This is essential information that you can use to help you move forward. 4, now take a step back and review your mentor map. What do you notice? Based on your answers to those questions, or anything else you notice, start to identify where you have missing mentors and misplaced mentors. Missing mentors are types of support that you will need moving forward, but don't currently have on your list. Misplaced mentors are mentors who are supporting you in areas where they are not particularly well suited to provide advice. A mentor who appears in too many of your areas of need may also be a misplaced mentor. Knowing this, shift or remove mentors from certain areas of your mentor map. Once you've completed these steps, you'll have a much better sense of what steps you need to take to strengthen the network of support around you. You can create a plan to fill in the missing mentors by developing new relationships and strengthening existing ones. As you develop these relationships, you will find people are much more inclined to say yes to providing support or advice on a particular topic than the question, "Will you be my mentor?" By sharing your vision for the future and clarifying your goals for these relationships, you are laying the groundwork for authentic and meaningful connections that will create a support system around you. In doing so, you avoid the risk of falling prey to the myth of the mentor. Alyssa F. Westring is the Vincent DePaul Professor and Chair of the Department of Management and Entrepreneurship at DePaul University's Dryhouse College of Business. She is the co-author of Parents Who Lead.